is part of my good luck ritual. Although I also thought that every year if I did a podcast, the Chiefs would win the Super Bowl. That proved wrong last year when I talked to Pico Iyer. In a way, talking to you today, Michael, is sort of me keeping myself sane to prove to myself that I didn't really believe that was true.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is the latest installment in my annual Super Bowl special episodes. Last year, you might recall, I spoke with the travel writer Pico Iyer. This year's conversation centers on Chuck Klosterman's new book about football, and what makes it interesting is that I don't actually interview Chuck. I interview the sports writer Michael Weinreb, who's one of Chuck's closest friends and was his roommate in New York a good 20 years ago. In a sense, it's something of a two-person book club, wherein one member can speak to the idiosyncrasies of what it's like to play video games with the book's author. You might recall that I talked with Michael Weinreb more than 5 years ago about our mutual love of the 1995 Noah Baumbach movie Kicking and Screaming. Today we have a similar conversation about our mutual love of football, a game that neither one of us played but has nonetheless figured in our imaginative lives since we were young. Together, Michael and I talk about Chuck's book and unpack its theories about why football is the last remaining American monoculture and why it's the perfect sport to watch on TV. We talk about how watching games on TV versus watching them in person has something of a travel parallel, in that visiting, say, Paris is different than seeing its sights on television. We talk about the difference between emotional sports fans and analytical fans and why the game is something of a pagan ritual that is tied to the coming of the winter solstice. You might recall that my Super Bowl special podcasts have in recent years been something of a superstition ritual during years that my Kansas City Chiefs have been in the big game. This year, my Chiefs weren't in the Super Bowl. They didn't even make the postseason. So this episode could be proof that I'm not superstitious. Or it could be proof that this is part of an even deeper superstition ritual meant to bring my Chiefs good luck in future years. Whatever the case, this episode begins with a long preamble about why I chose to interview Michael instead of Chuck, even though I've been a fan of Chuck's writing for 25 years. Let's listen in. And, you know, Michael, the last time I talked to you, we talked about Kicking and Screaming, the movie. And you had come across my radar because I read somewhere that you'd watched that movie 200 times on VHS. And if there's one thing I like in the world of sports and culture, it's people whose fandom is more neurotic than mine, because it makes me feel comfortable with my own fandom. And so we had a fun conversation about Kicking and Screaming years ago. But much like I found that factoid, I think you came on my radar in the context of sports for This American Life broadcast, where you were talking about, you were the guy who on his honeymoon in Greece was streaming football content on his phone.
I mean, I do watch all the games. Like, we went on our honeymoon in Greece this year and I found myself following a football game on my cell phone at 10 o'clock at night, feeling like an idiot for doing it. I'm sitting in a hotel lobby in Athens and I'm following a football game on my cell phone.
I heard Michael do this over and over. Football is how he marks time, an organizing principle for his life.
And I thought, this is my guy, because the fact that I have a football-themed podcast in my, you know, episode of my mostly travel-themed podcast goes back to the fact that my comfort ritual when I first moved overseas, when I lived in Korea, was going to ESPN.com in like 1998 and just sort of hitting refresh for 3 or 4 hours while NFL games played out. And so I think there's something telling about the fact that young men from the U.S. are suddenly going through this ritual on the other side of the world in seemingly more important times of life. Another pretext why I'm doing this podcast is that Chuck Klosterman came out with a book called Football. And I've known of Chuck's work for 25 years now. When Fargo Rock City came out, I immediately read it. And he's sort of become this person, like every book he writes, I think, oh, I could have written that, but I'm glad Chuck wrote it because he sort of says it better than me. And then as we were saying before we started recording is that your relation to Chuck is much more direct, because about the time that I was refreshing ESPN in Korea, you were actually roommates with Chuck. And so there's an extent to which I'm interviewing you because if Chuck came on the podcast, I'd probably feel obligated to talk about his book as opposed to just going down personal rabbit holes. And so, Michael, you are my enabler in this conversation to just join me in going down football rabbit holes that might allude to Chuck's book, but might not, but in a way that maybe Chuck can appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, I have, as I've mentioned to you, I met Chuck in the late 90s before Fargo Rock City came out. We were both employed at the Akron Beacon Journal in Ohio. And so I've known him for almost like half my life now, which is kind of crazy to think about. And we have probably texted or talked about football, you know, 320 days a year since then. It's probably like, other than, you know, maybe family and things like that, it's probably the main, no, I would say more than family. It's probably the main topic of our conversation is football. Like that is what, that is how we communicate. We started playing this football video game when we were roommates in New York City, which is actually something Chuck talks about in the book, is our different styles of playing this college football video game and what that kind of says about him and the way he views football and the way I view football, I guess, too. So I feel pretty comfortable being his proxy in this conversation. And I know that when I've spoken to him, he was excited about this idea because it's sort of like a book club for his book where somebody who knows him about as well as anybody besides his wife is kind of able to talk about the thing that we enjoy the most, you know?
Yeah, in a way, we're sort of doing end around Chuck himself, and we're talking about his book in a way that I'm sure he'll appreciate. But I want to jump on the video game aspect, and later I want to talk about how I'm a football guy whose fandom does not encompass things like video games or fantasy football or red zone TV. But I think that is a legitimate, but yet I still startle my wife with how much emotion I put into football sometimes, even though I'm not like the traditional fantasy football league type guy. And so I want to jump on that, this video game difference between you and Chuck. You had different approaches to the video game of football. I'm curious to know what those were. And I'm curious to know, I have the sense that you have an emotional fandom that's tied to specific teams, whereas Chuck's fandom is more of an analytical fandom that is tied to the sport in general. And I think that this is an underappreciated, underspoken about aspect of football fandom, that you have stats fans and you have narrative fans. What do you make of that, and how would you talk about your relationship to Chuck in that context?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the video game stuff, we can talk about that first a little bit. That started when we were roommates in New York City in the early 2000s. Chuck was working at Spin Magazine and just randomly got a free PlayStation, I guess it was at the time. And
because of Spin Magazine?
Because of Spin Magazine, there was some woman, it's in the book, but there's some woman there who just had like a closet full of PlayStations, because that's how magazines used to work back in the glory days, where like these companies would just send them free stuff. So Chuck brought that thing back to the apartment, and we immediately purchased EA Sports College Football, because we're both, you know, kind of insane, rabid college football fans. And we can get into the way that our fandom is completely different in a minute. But in terms of actually playing the game, what happened was pretty interesting, where Chuck immediately became the most conservative video game player you've ever seen. You know, everybody grows up playing video games and you hop on Madden or whatever, and you just start throwing Hail Marys and deep passes, and you just kind of do things that you wouldn't do in real life. But Chuck was like, no, I have to play this game the way that football is played in real life. And at that point, you know, he was sort of embracing like this 1970s, you know, Woody Hayes, Bo Schembechler style, where it was like, I'm going to give the ball to the fullback three straight times. Or, you know, I'm going to throw only 3-yard passes, you know, and
had he played football video games before?
I don't know if he had or not. I mean, not probably not much, because, you know, I don't think he had a video game system as a kid.
This sounds like something he might tell his grandkids. Like, I couldn't skeuomorphize the video game football because I was using human strategies for a digital game.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. So he just, he couldn't get over, and he still can't get over that. Like, so that game existed until, you know, 2015, and then there were all these issues with college sports changing its format, so they stopped making the game for several years. We started playing again a couple of years ago. We haven't played as much just because he's got kids and, you know, it's kind of hard to find the right time to play. But when we do play, the same thing happens. But now I'm the one playing realistically because I'm the one who's throwing the ball downfield and, you know, running my quarterback and scrambling with the ball and, you know, doing and kind of making probably hero ball throws, as they might be called, you know, where you're spinning around and you know, but that's how football is now. And so I was sort of ahead of the game. Huh. Chuck is still playing it like, you know, it's 1972 when he's still running the fullback and, you know, putting in two tight ends and just playing the most conservative style you can imagine. And so I wound up winning 80% of the time because he'll go on a 17 play, 8 minute drive that takes up a quarter and a half in video game time. And then he'll fumble the ball at the 3 yard line, you know? So it's kind of the same. I don't know. It's weird how that sort of came to define our friendship in a way, you know? And that sort of gets into the other question you were talking about, which is the idea of processing football emotionally versus sort of processing rationally. I grew up in a college town at Penn State, you know, so I had a team, you know.
You dedicated your book to State College, Pennsylvania, your book about college football, right?
I guess I did. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's my hometown. Mm-hmm. That's where I grew up. That's where I went to college. This is where my parents still live, you know? And it's, there's an emotional attachment for me, you know?
You talked from Substack about like startling people, including Chuck, with the passion of your emotion, especially anger in watching Penn State football.
Yeah. I mean, he tends to exaggerate a little bit, but, the first football game we watched together, maybe not the first football game, the first Penn State game we probably watched together was Penn State versus Minnesota. I want to say 1997 or 98. Penn State was undefeated going into that game and they lost on a last second field goal. And I was, you know, I was upset and Chuck didn't really know how to process me being upset because he'd never really seen me react that way before. I don't remember it being as crazy as what he says. I mean, he seems to think that like I was like ready to throw him out a window or something, which is good because I lived on the first floor of the apartment building. But then I kind of remember like going to shop for CDs after that and then probably going to like eat Chinese food and then, you know, watch the late football game. So I don't think it was that bad, but like he doesn't get that because, you know, as people will read, and I hope they read the book, is that he roots for the game itself. Like he is more interested in, you know, the underdog winning or a close game. It almost doesn't matter who the teams are in a weird way. Chuck leans much more toward narrative fandom, but the interesting thing about his narrative fandom is that it's sort of whatever that narrative is at the moment. You know, it's not, I'm a Chiefs fan, so I'm going to root for the Chiefs and follow that narrative. It's okay, Indiana is good now. Now I'm interested in this narrative. I'm going to start following this narrative. So when you sort of have that mercenary aspect of it, he can sort of pick and choose his narratives, which is both a blessing and a curse, I think, because as he also mentions in the book, and this is probably true for all three of us, he wants to watch every single game because there's a narrative involved in every single game. If you're watching a Mid-American Conference football game between Toledo and Akron on a Tuesday night, there's a narrative there, you know? Yeah. So you can almost, you know, follow every single narrative rather than sort of like us being like, okay, there are certain narratives that I'm going to prioritize over other narratives.
Well, there's probably a whole separate podcast, you know, maybe done by all of our wives and romantic interests about sort of the emotional navigation that comes through sports fandom and sort of the way, like, I'm sort of a fair weather Chiefs fan. I really enjoy watching the Chiefs. It's a fun era to be a Chiefs fan. But when I have watched the two Super Bowls where the Chiefs got blown out, first by Brady's Bucks and then last year by the Philadelphia Eagles, my reaction so bewildered my wife that, you know, she was sort of walking on eggshells. It was a sort of emotion she wasn't prepared to see. And so she thinks it's about Chiefs love, but it's so complicated. It's not just about Chiefs love, but it's also about being around people who don't care about football as much as I do. And so they're talking about the Super Bowl snacks and what they're going to do later and what happened last week. And I just have no interest in that. And so it's not just a Chiefs love thing, but it's a football love thing. I think, you know, in a way that Chuck outlined in his book, that it wasn't just me being upset that the Chiefs were losing. It was me being upset that the Chiefs were losing around people who didn't care as much as I did.
Yeah, I find that troublesome too. Because I live in California, normally I'll just watch Penn State games by myself, and then my current partner will just leave the house because she doesn't want to be around it. But now that I watch 49ers games, we'll go to the bar sometimes, and I have a group of a couple friends who sort of take the team seriously and, you know who everybody is and, you know the names and know the narrative of it. And I want to be around them, but like last weekend, you know, a bunch of other people showed up at the bar and they're kind of more casual fans. And I just kind of was like, I don't want to sit at that table. I want to sit at the table with the people who want to process the game and talk about the game in real time. And want to think about, you know, yeah, I don't want to hear them talking about, you know, the ChatGPT commercial or whatever, you know, like I want to talk about the game. I want to talk about Brock Purdy. I want to talk about, you know, Kyle Shanahan, and that doesn't mean it has to be all serious. Like, you know, there's weird, quirky stuff to all of it, but it's hard when you are a fan like that, to sort of be around that casualness when you're like, this is a serious moment. Why are you not taking this seriously? You know? Well, and then you feel stupid for feeling that way, but you know.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's not just that you're emotional, and by you I mean me, when the Chiefs were losing in the Super Bowls, it's that I'm emotional in front of people who can't make sense of that emotion, who don't share in that emotion at all.
Yeah.
And so, like, my podcast audience doesn't ask me for more football podcasts, but I keep giving them more football podcasts. A year ago from my Super Bowl special that nobody asked for, I interviewed Pico Iyer, who's sort of my travel writing role model, Time Magazine.
Yeah, sure. A star of Marty Supreme now as well. Yeah.
Totally. And actually, I just re-listened to that. And he said, I asked him about the game last year. And he says, I'm not sure if I can watch it live because I'm doing this movie.
What is your Super Bowl ritual going to be this year?
That's a very sensitive subject, Rolf, because I will be back in Japan, and actually I'm involved in a small way in a movie, so I may be on the movie set, in which case there's no chance of my watching it. I may be able to persuade my daughter to sign me up for another free month in a Japanese streaming service.
No idea what he was talking about. I thought maybe he was a consultant or a writer. And then I watched this ping pong movie and he has multiple speaking scenes, which was
I had no idea it was him until I read the New York Times story. Like, I didn't even know. But anyway, if anybody hasn't seen it, the movie's fantastic. But
And it's like, I don't know, I have a unique relationship to Pico Iyer just because his writing really made me realize I could do the kind of writing that I do. And then suddenly my travel writing hero is actually, I'm sitting with my actress wife and we're sort of impressed by Pico's performance. But a year ago I spoke to him about football because of course he's really into NFL football. And so my guest a year ago was him, but he was talking about how when he went to when he had the chance to go to a Lakers game, a basketball game when he was young, he was excited about meeting Chick Hearn as he was any of the players, Chick Hearn being the announcer for the team. And I think that sort of the ringerization of sports, the Grantlandization of sports, has sort of changed the way that we receive these things. Because I was telling Pico that I was really excited to talk to Wesley Morris on my podcast. He's been on my podcast a couple of times. And I've realized that I like Wesley's writing, but even more, I like listening to him talk on podcasts, right? And I haven't read any of Bill Simmons' books, But I'm, you know, I'm a diehard for his sports and his movies podcast. And it's the same for Chuck. You know, I read all his early books, but then he has become this person in my ear that I wasn't his roommate like you were, Michael, but it feels like this smart guy who I want to ask about certain sports things. And so it's almost like and we can talk in a second about how the football world has changed, which is something he addresses in his book, but it feels like the media world has changed.
Yeah, I'd be curious for you, like, I assume you grew up wanting to write about travel and reading people like Pico Iyer. And isn't there still something special about consuming the written word of people who can craft sentences that well?
Well, absolutely. And with Pico, it is. There's an interesting parallel between Pico and some of these other people that we talked about, like Chuck. Whereas Pico is such a good craftsman when it comes to writing, but he also speaks in complete paragraphs. And then Chuck is a riffer. I really like reading him on the page, but he's really good at riffing in podcasts. And you mentioned the Bill Simmons podcast from a couple of weeks ago. I think he was smart as always, but he's following Bill Simmons' line of questioning and Bill Simmons' interest in things. And that's part of maybe why I thought it would be more interesting to talk to you than to talk to him for this particular podcast, because I have Chuck's word on the page. Whereas, you know, I would just be taking him down, you know, little Kansas rabbit holes or, you know, sort of talking about scaring my wife when in fact, there's a bigger issue to which it is spoken. But I agree with you that the written word is special, and I think it needs to be celebrated and protected at a time where we can get excited about 20 books a year and then scratch that itch by listening to the author on podcasts instead of actually reading the books. And I think that there's a medium is the message aspect to this, that oral culture is fun, but it could be making our brains softer. And this made me think about one thing that I'm thinking about, I thought about in the context of Chuck's book, where he talks about TV as the perfect medium through which to watch a football game. It was as if it was made for TV. Well, this year, a couple of high school teams that I was interested in became good, including my wife Kiki's high school team. Like, she was a drama nerd growing up, wasn't interested in sports, but suddenly it was exciting to go to football games. And then you can stream them when you're not watching them. And so her team won the 1A state championship in Kansas. And then my sister teaches high school at a 2A school, and they were the state runners up. But you can stream those games and actually see them better, to Chuck's point in the book, than you could if you were sitting there in person. And so I'm wondering...
Is 1A the smallest classification in Kansas, or is that one of the largest?
That's one of the smallest, yeah.
That's one of the smallest. So, like, how many students are at this school?
Oh, my wife would kill me for not knowing. A couple hundred? Two or three hundred?
Two or 300. And so this is like, you know, this is grassroots high school football you're watching here, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, you would go to the game in person, and they would auction a quilt at halftime to raise money for the cheerleaders. I mean, it's like going to a football game in the 1920s or something.
Yeah.
But then you watch it, then you stream it on YouTube, and that's actually, it's more enjoyable, but I guess that's sort of what I'm throwing out here is like this going to affect football culture upstream or downstream when even high school games for schools with 300 students are being broadcast on YouTube. I'm just wondering if the medium, you know, Chuck sort of had this formula that TV is perfect for football, sort of almost retroactively, but will TV change football? Certainly already has, you know, with the way it has become easier to follow on a television. I'm just wondering if this is going to have a grassroots, not that they're going to auction quilts at the Super Bowl anytime soon, but I wonder if somehow... the fact that even the smallest of small schools in Kansas, a very lightly populated part of the country, the fact that they can also stream games, if that's going to bleed into the culture, if it's just a result of culture.
I think it's just a result of culture. I still think going to that game is obviously a different experience than watching that game on the stream, right? I mean, you don't get to see the quilt. Maybe you do get to see the quilt auction. Maybe they show it live on the stream or something. But just the experience of being there in that little, you know, however many seats that stadium has, which is probably, what, like a few hundred or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, talking about the opposite scale, I go back to a Penn State game once every year or two. Completely different experience. That's 107,000 people in a stadium, you know, the tailgating fields go on for miles and miles and miles. It's the third biggest city in the state on Penn State football Saturdays behind Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. It's a completely different experience. You're not going to be able to follow the game as well as you are on TV, but you're going to be able to experience that emotion of watching the game and of kind of feeling the game in a way that you don't on television. And I don't think that's going to go away. I think it's, you know, become really expensive to go to a lot of these games. I also think it depends on the atmosphere. So I'm sure I don't think I've ever been to Arrowhead Stadium, but it seems like it's a pretty amazing atmosphere. Whereas I've been to the 49ers Stadium in Santa Clara and it's terrible. Huh. It's awful. It's hot. Half of the stadium is just like baked in sun. And there's no escaping it. It's in the middle of nowhere. There's like not even a bar or a restaurant nearby. It's an awful, awful experience. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well. And I think the people who are in charge of these things are starting to figure that out. They figured it out with baseball, right? Where it's like, you, part of the reason that you go to a baseball stadium now is because it's a cool stadium. Yeah, there aren't a lot of uncool stadiums in baseball anymore. Football, you know, there's bigger arenas, bigger places, but it's kind of that same thing where you're going more to feel the game than to watch the game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I wonder if this is sort of the bifurcation of football fandom. There's like the pagan ritual, going there in person, eating the food, painting your face, right?
Yeah.
Then there's the analytical ritual of watching it and having, it's just amazing how much information there is on a TV screen now compared to the 1970s when you turned on a football game and you didn't really know what down it was or what the score was until they went to a commercial. And so, yeah, I go to one Chiefs game a year and I've never seen the Chiefs lose actually. In like a half a dozen games, I've never seen them lose. And so that is a part of my good luck ritual. Although I also thought that every year if I did a podcast, the Chiefs would win the Super Bowl. That proved wrong last year when I talked to Pico Iyer. In a way, talking to you today, Michael, is sort of me keeping myself sane to prove to myself that I didn't really believe that was true, right? That I can just talk about football and not have stakes in the Chiefs game. But yeah, a buddy and I go every year.
Let me bring it back because you said this wasn't a travel. This is not, you know, you're alienating your travel podcast audience, right? But how does this compare the conversation we're having about TV versus attending a game? Going to Paris versus watching a documentary about Paris. Is it similar? Do you think it's different? I mean, is the contrast more stark when you're talking about going places and seeing things?
That's a great thing to bring up. And I feel silly for not like posing that as a question in my outline. because literally when I teach travel writing in Paris every summer, we talk about that. It's five senses, you know, that, there's a reason why travel is called sightseeing, you know, is that was sort of in the early 18th century, an Anglican priest called William Gilpin decided that was the most important thing to do and you should make sketches. And then if a decade later, they invented the camera and pretty soon sight is the most important sense in travel. Well, sight is important too in the intellectualized TV version of football, that you can process information, but you can't smell it, you know, that you can sort of hear some ambient noise, but you can't really hear it. You can cook yourself some nachos, but it's not like eating a hot dog that you bought at the stadium. And then it's amazing how having been to Chiefs games every year for the past several years, that there's this communitas that you're high-fiving and hugging people that you don't know, you know, that you're sort of exchanging information, even if they're from another team, you know, like I went to the Chiefs Lions game this year and I'm like, hey, Lions fan, I went to high school with Barry Sanders. And they're like, oh my God. And then so suddenly you have this connection. And so I guess maybe, and we're just thinking out loud here, like going to a bar is somehow in between those things because there is a community aspect to it. But this is, I'm going to have to think about this. Maybe I'll just think a lot about it now, but it's the difference between watching Rick Steves' Paris, where you might learn more than you do on the ground, but wandering through the street in Paris and being surprised, you know? And so.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember I don't travel a ton, but I went to Spain and just going to some random cafe in Pamplona, and there was just this group of guys just singing songs and drinking, you know, and that's the kind of experience you can get sometimes at a football game, at a tailgate or something, you know, where it's just, you know, people doing their rituals, and you can experience it in a way that you're not going to experience it on TV.
Oh, I think it has to extend to the tailgating too. You mentioned this in the context of Penn State games. The Kansas City Chiefs are a great tailgating culture, and I'm amazed by how not just cross-racial but cross-class it is. You have people tailgating, some of whom clearly they're spending a huge chunk of their monthly paycheck for whatever job they have, and this is part of their happiness. And they're hanging out with middle-class people, and I don't know if there's as many upper-class people in the parking lot, but just in terms of sitting in the stands, I would look around sometimes and think, this is one of the more racially diverse crowds I've been in than I typically am in the course of a year. And so I think that if you extend the football game experience to the tailgating, and you should, because even in high school, even before the quilt auction, we tailgated before the high school game and we talked to local people. And yeah, I think going in person is sort of like traveling the world. It's getting your passport and actually sort of committing financially and of yourself to a game rather than watching six games at once, you know.
Yeah, right.
On red zone football.
Because it's easier to be lazy now, you know. It's easier to order DoorDash than to go to a restaurant. It's easier to watch a football game on TV than to actually go to a football game and think about the hassle that you're going to. And, you know, it's easier not to travel and watch Rick Steves, who's great, but watch him, you know, than to actually go to these places. So you almost have to force yourself out of your comfort zone. Because of what Chuck's saying, football is so good on television, you know, that you have to force yourself not to watch it on television or even just to go to a bar, you know, to kind of be, at least get into that middle range.
I was thinking, you know, I was talking about the pagan nature of going to football games in person. And this is a question I might posit, I would posit to Chuck, which is that how important to football is the fact that it sort of ends at the winter solstice, that football seasons become sort of pagan centric because they start in the fall and they end at the shortest time of the year. And would football be different? I'm curious to know what you think, Michael, if it was a spring sport. Right? How important is the winter? Is the coming darkness to the rite of football?
I think so. That's interesting because Chuck mentioned this on, I think he mentioned on the Simmons podcast, but we've talked about it a bunch too. Is that the one chapter that he didn't get to write for this book was about football and weather and the relationship between football and weather? Because there's nothing cooler than watching a snow game, right? When you're watching a game that's played in the snow, it's beautiful. Like there's just something artistic about it. Even watching a game in like heavy rain. I mean, that's another thing that when Chuck and I play the video game, he always engineers it for inclement weather because that's one of the things that he loves about watching games is that football is an outdoor sport that you play, you know, rain or shine. And so I think it fits into that idea you're talking about where it's a hard sport. It's a brutal sport. It's a violent sport. And you get into those dark days and you get into like, you know, the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field, right? That's like the most famous thing that NFL Films has ever done.
Right.
And for a reason, you know, it's because that idea of what football is, that it's just this, you know, Protestant work ethic, just, you know, just breaks people apart, you know, literally just the people who play it, the toll it takes on them. But there's still something worthwhile about, you know, getting through that winter, you know, kind of working your way through that winter with this sport. It's an interesting aspect of football that Chuck and I talk about all the time. Yeah.
Well, it's like it's being indigenous to the sport as opposed to being mediated in the sport. You know, like indigenous cultures have a relationship to the land that's been lost now. And so in a way, this ritual is bringing us back to the tactile concreteness of the seasons and being in a certain place in a certain time and not watching the Red Zone, you know, broadcast. You know, I was wondering, somebody should do a statistical analysis of football movies and how many football movies hinge on weather. I can't think of too many football movies that take place on AstroTurf, right? Like there's that Friday Night Lights episode where they can't use their field, and so they take a cow field and they turn it into this mud sloppy mess, and it's just, they celebrate it as this time where they're getting back to the real game.
Because it just looks cool, right? I mean, if you're filming a movie about football, like, I think that Tom Cruise, All the Right Moves, isn't there, like, you know, it's always kind of inclement weather. I think it was filmed in Pittsburgh, you know?
Okay.
Like, even like, there was that movie, The Last Boy Scout, which is more like a crime movie.
Right, yeah.
But there's a scene in the beginning where a guy shoots somebody else on a football player shoots another guy. It's a ridiculous movie. but it's driving rain, you know, it's like this driving rainstorm when the game is happening. It just fits in so well with what the ethos of the game is.
Well, they've talked about having more cold weather Super Bowls just because there's something sort of a little bit clinical about having a warm weather Super Bowl every year. Have you read A Fan's Notes by Frederick Exley?
Yeah, it's been a long time, but I mean, it's an amazing book. Yeah, it's crazy, but it's brilliant. Yes.
Right. Well, I brought a quote from that. He says, "Why did football bring me so to life? I can't say precisely. Part of it is my feeling that football is viewed as an island of directness in a sea of circumspection. It's smacked of something old, something traditional, something unenclosed by leisure domain and subterfuge." And so it feels like that sort of ties in what we're talking about now, that there's something... Well, I think this is the balance, you know, that you have this game that's perfect to be televised, yet it represents something that is sort of a return to warrior culture and sort of an indigenous relationship to weather. What do you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. And I mean, Chuck talks, you know, in the book, there's a lot of overarching stuff about, you know, the metaphors for war and how football sort of fits in to that whole ethos, and just sort of wrestling with these ideas of the toll that football takes on the people who play it, you know? So I think the weather being, you know, getting to that solstice weather, the brutal, dark, cold, it fits in certainly to, you know, you're talking about being a narrative fan. Nothing fits more into the narrative of fandom than like a snow game, right? Than like a cold weather, dark, you know, just miserable, guys can't hold on to the football, you know, hitting somebody just feels like you're gonna die, you know. I think that all sort of is that healthy? That's a different conversation we can have about, with, you know, what does that say about masculinity and about toxic masculinity and all those sorts of things. But just in terms of the larger American metaphor, it kind of fits in perfectly, doesn't it?
Well, it does at many levels. And I think that there's, I mean, even metaphorically, football becomes a metaphor for like high school, for like the pecking order of high school, you know, that even if you didn't play football, you complain about high school life in terms of the jocks who made your life hell, right?
Right.
And then Chuck actually talks about the idea that football is like the last remaining monoculture now. You know, it's like I think he threw out a statistic of like of the 93 most or the 100 most watched television broadcasts a couple of years ago, 93 of them were football games or NFL games. But then he also talks about how this football could be seen as this barbaric manifestation of a certain time in history when we didn't live in an enlightened way. He compares it to like gladiators. He brings up the fact that just historically, boxing and horse racing used to be a big thing in a way that they aren't now. And so what do you think? Do you think that this will be seen as a throwback eventually, or is it enough part of the cyclical, solstice-driven, pagan part of our nature to always hang on?
I know, it's hard to imagine football not being just a central part of the culture. So I was very skeptical when I read that. Mm-hmm. But I do sort of wonder, you know, how it will change, because even if you look back 20, even 10 years ago, they've started to legislate at least some of the gratuitous violence out of it, mm-hmm. you know? Is it safe? No, not by any means. It's not safe to play football. You know, I mean, it's definitely you're taking a risk. You know, there's that famous quote from Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, where he's like, well, you're taking a risk sitting on your couch, you know, which like mm-hmm. he deservedly took a lot of flack for. You know, I just don't, it's harder for me to imagine that football can just sort of vanish from the zeitgeist like that. You know, I mean, you're talking about going to people going to high school football games in tiny little towns in Kansas. Mm. Is that going to go away? I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine what ritual would replace it.
Well, here's another thing in the context of masculinity and my own life. Like, I never played football. I never went out for football. Yeah. I played flag football. I was pretty good with the Nerf back in the day. I ran track, and I was good at track. I ran NAIA, the 1500. I was a pretty good 1500 runner. An American male has won the 1500 in the Olympics in 2016 and 2024, and I didn't even turn on the TV either time. The event in the sport that I grew up on, my own country, is on the gold medal stand, and I don't even know if I've watched those races on YouTube. Whereas I will turn on, you know, a Bears-Colts game and just watch it because it interests me. And so this is a weird thing. You talk about masculinity. I can't explain this. I think a lot of this is covering ground that one can't explain. I don't know why I don't follow track, which I used to run, you know, miles and miles and miles. I was in such a good shape. I thought about it a lot. But as a fan, I'm a little bit ambivalent about track. Why on earth do I follow football? I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm proving Chuck's points from his book. I don't know if you have any ideas about...
Well, you know who's probably the biggest track and field fan I know is Chuck Klosterman.
No kidding.
I don't... It's almost become a joke now where, you know, it'll be a day... Now it's like it's a day in June and there's some sort of championship, you know, like the Penn Relays or something is on, and he's like, I'm watching track and field. You know, he'll just text me and be like, I'm watching track and field. But it's, you know, it's not the same. There's something about football that's just, it's just different.
Even like, I wasn't raised, like my mom sort of tried to keep me out of physical altercations as a boy, but I just locked onto football in a crazy way. And I would draw pictures of football players. I had a little Coleco electric football team. I had a little, like a little league where I'd play against myself and keep track of the teams in a notebook. And have you been to the Rock Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland?
Yeah. Many, many years ago. Yeah.
I remember walking through and seeing this little drawing of football players. And it's like, why on earth are those here? Well, Jimi Hendrix drew players of Big Ten football players when he was a kid, and they put those in the Rock Hall of Fame. You know, guy, he was never destined to be an athlete. Maybe Hendrix was good at sports. I don't know. But just that somehow this, again, we'd have to get a psychologist on here, and what would they know? How does this land into the brain space of young boys? You know, I mean,
I did all the things you're talking about were things I did too. You know, yeah. I drew pictures. Mm-hmm. I had that Coleco football game.
Yeah,
I had another, you know, one of those board games called Status Pro Football. I also had Status Pro Baseball, and mm-hmm. I would just over the summer, that's all I would do was just play those games. You know, so. Yeah, and I wasn't a football player. I wasn't big enough to play football. But there was just something about it that was just, I don't want to say it, maybe instinctual, I don't know.
Speaking of toxic masculinity, I remember my dad was a professor at Friends University, another KCAC tiny school in Kansas. I remember they lost a football game when I was like six, and I was crying after the game, and my parents were really worried about me. Like, Rolf is taking this game too seriously. So I think that you get a certain kind of passion shamed out of you when you're a kid, that you're not supposed to be crying over
sports. You do. Yeah, that happened when Penn State lost to Alabama in the Sugar Bowl in 1979.
Okay.
I remember crying. And then, you know, your parents just sort of look, my parents were laughing almost, you know. But, you know, and then you're like, okay, I guess I'm not supposed to do that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's, you know, the big female complaint about men is that they're not in touch with their emotions. And it's like, well, people made fun of us when we cried when the Friends Falcons or the Nittany Lions lost, and we haven't been able to get back in touch with their emotions since.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Chuck Klosterman's book Football and Michael Weinreb's sports books and Substack, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.